The treatment of mental health patients is never far from the news, and on today's Outlook, we'll be talking to a patient-turned-doctor who's so exercised about the issue that he's pushed to bed with a dummy patient about 100 kilometres from the English coastal town of Brighton to the City of London. Welcome once again from Russell Fuller. Dr. Rufus May kicks off another week of Outlook in just a moment. We'll also be talking to a man who's been nominated for the title of Australian Father of the Year for the way he's coped with his son's imprisonment in the American military prison at Guantanamo Bay. And we've details of our new competition. Remember, we'd like to hear about your memorable journeys, whether it be by car, bus, train, rickshaw, or even horse and cart. And in fact, my first guest has been on a memorable journey. People travelling to work in the south of England last week may have been rubbing their eyes in disbelief at the convoy heading their way, as on the road from Brighton to London, a group of people dressed in pyjamas and pushing a bed with a dummy patient were being pursued by a giant syringe. The bed push was organised by the clinical psychologist Dr. Rufus May to protest against forced medication for the mentally ill. The United Nations will discuss the subject later this week, and Rufus has first-hand experience as both doctor and patient, having been treated, forcibly, for schizophrenia as a teenager. Rufus is with us now. Welcome to Outlook, Rufus.
Thank you.
Maybe you can give us an idea of what you went through. It was only the mid-1980s, it was only about 20 years ago. What sort of treatment did you receive at the time?
Right, well, I was suffering from a kind of identity crisis, really, and my girlfriend had left me, and rather than get depressed, I sort of escaped into a fantasy reality, really. But when my parents got very concerned about me and I wasn't sleeping and behaving very unpredictably, I ended up getting admitted to a psychiatric hospital in East London. And they quickly gave me a diagnosis of schizophrenia, told me that I'd have to take medication for the rest of my life. And when I disagreed with that prognosis and treatment, I was forced to take medication. So I was pinned down, I had my trousers pulled down, and this was a very frightening experience. And then I felt this pain as the needle was injected into my buttock. And I then got very groggy, and this happened several times in various admissions, where the aim was to get me to accept that I should always be on this medication, and whereas I actually realised that I needed something to help me sleep, or some process, but the act of forcing medication upon me actually put me off medication, and made me very upset and angry. Mm.
So as well as the effects of the drugs themselves, the fact that you were pinned to the floor like that and a needle was forced into you must have had quite an impact on you.
Definitely. It sort of robs you of your dignity, really. You can either kind of give up, become spirit broken in a way. It can break your spirit. Or you just get very hostile towards the services that are supposed to be helping you.
Well, yeah, you were suggesting there that you didn't have any choice in the matter at all. Do they not have to get any signed consent from you?
No, there is a sort of get-out clause, human rights law. If you're of unsound mind, the rules that protect you from having things forced upon you, which is tantamount to torture, really. The rules don't apply. So if you're judged to not have any capacity, then for your own good, you can be given these treatments. But I think they're actually counterproductive and actually cause a lot of deaths, either directly or indirectly.
And you've got experience of that, haven't you? A close friend of yours?
Yeah, a close friend of mine was given so much medication because of the narrow-minded approach that was being applied. No one knew how to manage her distress or listen to her or explore why she was distressed. Instead, she was given larger and larger doses of medication, which made her put on weight, made her tremble, dribble, and she lost all her sense of self-pride and eventually jumped off a building and killed herself.
You can't be sure it was the medication that drove her to do that, can you?
No. But it was a narrow-minded approach to her problems that wasn't helping. And it was also the fact that I was very struck when I went to the funeral that there were hundreds of people there. And I thought, well, where were these people when she was in hospital in distress? So I actually thought we need to change the whole way our society approaches mental health, that we don't just devolve responsibility to unknown professionals.
So you weren't offered any alternative therapies at the time, Rufus?
No. Talking therapies were seen as bad for me. If you talked with me about my unusual ideas, staff were told that would be colluding, that would make me worse. So I was left in isolation with my ideas and experiences. I thought the radio was talking to me directly with special messages. I thought I was involved in a spy espionage story. I thought there was a big spiritual battle going on between good and evil. But no one was trying to help me make sense of those experiences. So I think that's also quite abusive. That is beginning to change now in Western approaches to mental health. They've acknowledged that talking with people doesn't do people harm. But we still have an overemphasis on diagnosing people and medicating them to solve the problem. I think that just suppresses people's experiences. The madness or the distress is there for a reason. And we need to find out what that reason is and help people address the emotional reasons, the social experiences that have led to that distress. But if you just suppress it with medication, it will come back in another way. So people who are on long-term medication tend to not recover because the problem keeps getting suppressed.
There's a very fine line, isn't there, Rufus, between somebody with a very vivid imagination and somebody like yourself who ultimately was diagnosed with schizophrenia. You, I think, were bored at work, weren't you, when you were working as a teenager and started inventing stories just to pass the time of day.
That's right. I started to think, what if I'm not at the beginning of a dull career as an office junior? What if I'm an apprentice spy? What if this is a front for a spy organisation? And when I was asked to deliver parcels across the country, I started to imagine, what if this is a special mission, a test, to see if I can deliver parcels in difficult circumstances. Particularly when I lost my ticket at the station, I thought somebody must have pickpocketed it just to test me out. And that's right, the more I got into these fantasies, the more real they became, the more I looked for evidence to support them, the more real that world became.
So at what point do you become mentally ill?
It's a good question. The Buddhists say that we're all mentally ill. None of us perceive reality accurately. I think when you're judged to be mad is when other people give up on trying to understand you. But I think everybody who presents as mad or extremely disturbed, if you really listen to them, you can start to break the code of what's the meaning is of their experience.
So ultimately, you decided that you weren't going to stay on this medication. You signed yourself off effectively, didn't you? Have you had problems since?
Not with psychiatric services.
One or two other problems that maybe we don't want to go into now.
No, I mean, we all have problems. I've managed to avoid psychiatric services. I'm in a long-term relationship with two children, very happy, got a career as a clinical psychologist, so things are going well.
So how did things improve for you? If you came off the medication, was it as simple as that? Is that how you see it, that you came off the medication and magically things became a lot clearer?
No. It was support. I was very lucky that in my own family there was a powerful story of recovery. My mother had a brain hemorrhage when I was 11 and was severely disabled mentally and physically by that. But my father helped her recover. He got a network of friends to visit each day and do different exercises with her. And I saw her recover through her own will and determination and the support of others. And I knew, so I think there was a blueprint there for me that I had to be really determined not to believe the prophecy, the doom and gloom prophecy of self-fulfilling prophecy of schizophrenia. I knew I had to believe in myself as having potential, and I knew I had to pull in other people. So I went to community centres, I went to churches, a close friend stood by me and refused to write me off. And these are the things that helped me claw my way out of the psychiatric sort of trap that I found myself in.
And ultimately, is that why you tried to become a psychologist yourself?
That's right, to help other people. And I create self-help groups that aim to create those kind of support networks, enabling support networks.
Did your colleagues know about your history?
No.
And did you have to lie on the application form?
I did have to lie on my occupational health form. I would have been discriminated against. I wouldn't have been allowed to train if I'd have been open about being given this label, schizophrenia. So I kept very quiet about it, and I ended up feeling like the spy of my delusions. My delusions came true in a way, and because there I was, sitting in ward rounds, just a few miles from where I'd been a patient, and now in the chair as a professional.
Did anybody recognise you?
On one occasion, a nurse recognised me, but he couldn't place me because I was out of context. He's saying, "I know you from somewhere," and I'm sort of grinning at him through gritted teeth, saying, "Yeah, let's talk about this later, shall we?" And he was very nice. He said, "Well, that's confidential. You know, I respect what you're doing." And so I waited till I'd proved myself as a competent practitioner, if you will, before I came out about my previous career as a psychiatric patient.
And what was the reaction?
People were shocked. People were very shocked. I've done a good job as posing as a very sane professional.
Mm. But you see, I would have thought you were perfectly qualified for the job because you've got that experience that we all need if we're going to do the job properly.
You'd think that, but there's a lot of prejudice in mental health services. The expert has to be this sane, sort of squeaky clean practitioner who rationally solves all his problems before breakfast and then comes into work. So in drug rehab services, there's a recognition that if you've been a former addict, you'll make a good drug counsellor. But that's still, there's so much stigma around mental health, so much fear about being labelled as mentally ill, that if you've got that history, it still counts against you.
Hmm.
Most people, there are many people like me working in services using their own experience of distress, but they're too frightened to be open about it because of the discrimination that's there. It's subtle, it's like racism.
So your methods have changed. You're not carrying out some of the methods that were used on you 20 years ago. You talked about group therapy. I think you're also using Tai Chi, aren't you, and working with an African healer?
That's right. Recovery's got to be a creative process. I think helping people recover from serious mental health problems is an art, not a science. And we use Tai Chi. We have Tai Chi classes in the community and in the hospital, and self-help groups where we tell everyone that everyone has wisdom and expertise here. It's not just the men in white coats, as it were. And we try and pool our wisdom together. And recently, we've been working with an African healer and community artist who's been coming up. And he hears voices himself, but sees them as spiritually valuable, and his voices help him help other people who hear voices. So it's a very different approach, but many people find it very helpful. He's very good at connecting with people using art, creativity, and spirituality. So we're prepared to try give people choices. There's no one-size-fits-all approach,
so just
which is what the pharmaceutical industry wants you to think, that the best thing is to get the right diagnosis and the right pill, and that will solve your problems. Mm. But in actual fact, these aren't medical problems. These are spiritual problems, these are life problems, problems of living in a world that's often hostile and difficult.
So do some people need to have medication forced upon them still, Rufus? Are some people unable to make a choice for their own welfare, and the welfare of the community as well, because we do hear about mentally ill patients killing innocent people.
Sure.
Do they need to have medication forced upon them?
No, because violence creates violence. We see that all around the world. If you go in and intervene violently in a country, you create a backlash, and that's the same with individuals. The way safe, sound, supportive mental health services are ones people will trust, ones that brutalise the person, people they won't trust. So I think we create a lot of these problems. I know a young man who, he was so scared about going back into mental health services. He knew that he was getting paranoid and losing control, but he was so scared about going back into mental health services, he isolated himself in a disused building and he died of exposure. That's the kind of effect of this violence that goes on in psychiatric hospitals. And I think we could create a peaceful approach to mental health services. I've been in many situations where I've talked people down from volatile situations and given them choices about ways to calm down, and that's been effective.
Rufus, it's been very good talking to you. Just before you go, tell us about some of the strange looks you must have received on the route from Brighton to London.
Right.
Just very briefly, did you get some strange looks?
Yes, if you go to bedpush.com, you'll read all about it.
Ah, you tease. That's the perfect way to sell a website. Thank you very much indeed to Dr. Rufus May.